You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 24, 7.1 surround sound flute action. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including new developments surrounding the next movie, more confirmed guests for Star Trek Las Vegas 2012, the second teaser trailer for TNG HD, Star Trek's 10 least threatening villains, and a look at some more upcoming IDW Star Trek comics. Plus, we'll be previewing two more tracks from 5-Year Mission's next album, Year 2. And then in the feature, we'll be joined by Hyperchannel host Tristan Riddell as we discuss the two-parter from Deep Space Nine, Past Tense. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Oh, I'm doing fantastically. I actually hear it snowed yesterday, which is crazy because it's still November, but I guess that's what you get for living in Seattle.
I guess so. Yeah, when I lived in Reno, we would get snow in October. So we often would go trick-or-treating in the snow, which was, was fine. I kind of missed that a little bit.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So has the summer ended yet in Tokyo?
It's trying. It's trying very hard. It's having moderate success, but it is starting to feel, especially at night, yeah, it's feeling a bit cooler. Actually cold sometimes, so I'm glad about that. So, Greg, this is going to be our Thanksgiving week show. Mm-hmm. And first of all, do you have any plans for Thanksgiving?
You know, I probably do. I have various people inviting me over. You know, it's one of those things, whenever you have no family in the environs, people take pity on you and take you in. I don't know if you watched The New Girl, but that Zooey Deschanel show. But they just had their show where, you know, you have that disastrous single men try to cook Thanksgiving dinner and it goes horribly awry. So I'm trying not to do that. And I'll probably go over to somebody's house.
All right.
Is Thanksgiving, do they even know Thanksgiving in Japan? I'm trying to remember.
Not so much. No, I mean, it's already around here. Meg Milk already has Christmas milk cartons
right out.
KFC, since late October, a little bit before Halloween, the big statue of Colonel Sanders, which is outside of every KFC, has been dressed like Santa Claus.
Perfect.
And the stores already have Christmas decorations, Christmas posters and things up. So, you know, we go straight into Christmas. And actually, this Wednesday is Labor Day here. And I was just thinking, you know, can't we at least get through Labor Day before Christmas kicks in? But no, it's Thanksgiving, not much of a thing here, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, will you be having a big Turkey Day festival in your own home?
No, we don't really do Thanksgiving. We will just be having probably a normal busy week around here. But what I might do is watch Generations and pretend that the Christmas scene is actually Thanksgiving.
Right.
And then when Picard goes through the Nexus, he ends up in a room where there are like a couple of his family members passed out in Lazy Boys watching a football
exactly.
game.
Yeah, I was
after
hoping,
eating too much turkey.
We'll get this show out, you know, and hopefully this can be counter-programming for, you know, while the rest of your family is sitting around drinking Bud Light, watching the football game, you can drink your artisan beer and listen to us in solitude.
That's right. That is our plan. That is what we do for you on Ready Room. All right. Well, why don't we jump into some Star Trek news here, Greg? First thing, finally, there are, well, I feel like we say this often recently, finally, there are a few new bits of information about the next Star Trek movie, but
there's a new Star Trek movie?
Rumor has it that they're planning to get it out. I think release date is going to be August 30th, 2024.
That sounds about right. Yeah,
so
I heard that Gabriel Bell is going to be lining up for the midnight showing.
I think so. And I heard that JJ wants BC as the villain in the next movie. No, he wants Benicio del Toro, apparently, which we've talked
yes.
about before. And some other information, rumor has it, this comes from Trek Movie, who first reported this, as far as I know, who said that they heard from a trusted source that filming is set to begin on January 15th, 2012. And
obviously this date has already been moved around quite a bit. Someone said that filming was supposed to start January of this year, and obviously we moved far past that date. But this does sound like it's a little more corroborated, because we do know, according to Roberto Orci, that the script is finished. Like, they basically have put the whole thing down. It's not just a scriptment or a treatment or an outline or a couple notes jotted on napkins. They have an actual script with people speaking.
We have a 10 napkin set. We have a 10 napkin treatment of the story.
Right.
And you know it's authentic because each napkin has two drink stains on it.
The rule is that Uhura has to ask Spock if he's okay on at least, you know, every other napkin.
Right, right. And every third napkin there's a hug scene. All right. Well, so some other information here that's come out is that reportedly ILM has already been working on effects shots that can be done without, you know, anything being shot yet. So there's enough story to go on for that. And another thing was that it was rumored that JJ recently traveled to Hawaii to scout locations that might be used as a jungle planet.
Oh, very
and
interesting.
I would think he has quite a lot of experience. I would think he would just shoot it on the Lost Island, but I was going to ask you, jungle planet, if this is true, does this mean anything to you in terms of our never-ending attempt to figure out what the story might be?
Well, which was the planet that they go to on TNG early on with the jungle planet with the security system?
Oh, the Arsenal of Freedom.
The Arsenal of Freedom. I was thinking this could be the Arsenal of Freedom, sort of done on the big screen.
Oh, okay. So they encounter the same planet.
Oh, sure.
100 years earlier.
Well, this is while the planet is still running. There's still the war going on. It's sort of a prequel to the TNG episode.
Right. So this is when Magrathea is still making planets. And the TNG episode is after the galactic economy has collapsed and Magrathea has kind of shut itself down, right?
Exactly. Well, jungle planets, you know, I really don't think of, you know, when I think of jungle, I don't think Hawaii, but I guess it is basically a jungle down there. But it's not going to be like, I don't know, South American jungle, that sort of thing, like really dense.
Yeah.
With you know, various animals roaming about. It would be interesting what they might do with a jungle, though. And what I'd really love to see is actual animals. We never see animals. Like, we see monsters from time to time. We see Horda. We see Tribbles. We see Glommers. But just flora and fauna. That's one thing I really loved about Avatar, was we went to this world, a jungle, of course, and we saw actual animals that lived there. And I'd love to see Star Trek's take on just resident, you know, what does a deer look like on random planet that they go on an away mission?
Well, they'll have to paint the deer purple, right?
Exactly.
Or paint them blue. Blue and purple, two different species of deer.
Well, there you go. Diversity.
Yeah, I don't know what this would mean, jungle planet. I was trying to figure out, like, does it give me any clues to the remaking or retelling of an original episode? I don't know. Maybe it could be the apple. You know, that had kind of a tropical setting.
That could work.
I was trying to relate it to what they're doing with the comics and then what they might be doing with the movie. But
yeah. And
they
did say also that they're going to be using a previously used location, like a famous location. So I do hope that means they're going back to Vasquez Rocks. You know, hopefully for the new Vulcan homeworld. I'd love to see that new planet, and hopefully it's like the Vulcan that they're used to, very volcanic and rocky.
Except that it's been taken over by Gorn now, right?
Oh, that would be great. Vulcan versus Gorn. Star Trek II, Vulcan versus Gorn.
Oh, that sounds like a winner. They also mentioned, in terms of another, like a known location, a museum in Los Angeles that is being looked at for shooting a famous Star Trek location. So I don't know what that is either in terms of a museum, but it sounds like they're suggesting that it is a Star Trek location that we're familiar with
from the original series or from movies. Again, I don't know.
Very interesting.
It's fun to get these little tidbits, though, and then we can speculate. You know, it's kind of like in football. There are games being played on the field, but all we actually do is we spend the entire season from before it starts to the end trying to guess who's going to play for the national championship. And this is kind of the same way. It's like they're off there working on their script and all, and we're just all over here sitting around trying to guess what the story's going to be about.
Right. One thing I did like to hear was that they have the Enterprise sets in storage. They didn't break them down sometimes happens. I wonder if they put the lens flares in storage as well. They can just pull those out.
Yeah, I think so. They keep them in the same kind of box that they kept that like a Medusa in the original series.
I was thinking they could go in the box like the Ark of the Covenant in Raiders.
Oh, yeah. Oh, can you imagine that? So the Nazis, they get the Ark and they take it out there into that clearing, and they're going to open it up. And then when they open it, all these JJ lens flares come flying out everywhere, and everyone's
camera starts rattling back and forth.
Oh, that's what we'll get when JJ reboots Indiana Jones.
Oh, don't give them ideas. Although I did have an idea that Shia LaBeouf could play Henry Jones Sr. in 1900s Scotland. But don't give them any ideas.
Oh, gosh. Boy, you know, they really, based on various episodes of The Ready Room, they really should hire us as writers. I mean, Star Trek would just be so interesting with our plot lines.
It would be something. We should probably move on to the next story.
Yeah, I guess we should. So like I said, it's fine to find out what these little tidbits are, and I'm sure we're going to get a whole lot more of them over the next few months, and we'll fill you in on them as they come along and find out where we think the movie is headed. But one thing that we do know for certain is that there's going to be a convention in Las Vegas next year, and a lot of famous Star Trek actors are going to be there.
Yeah, including special guest star Diana Muldaur.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of on the fence about whether I was going to go to Star Trek Las Vegas, but now that I know that Dr. Pulaski will be there, I already have been on the line with my travel agent and am lining up my plane tickets and my Latinum passes for the show. I have a special package where not only do I get to meet Dr. Pulaski, Diana Muldaur, and get her autograph, but I also get to have breakfast with her, and this is the kicker with the Latinum package. I had to pay a lot of money for this. I actually get to get a checkup from Dr. Pulaski.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Well. So who else is going to be there? I mean, now Diana Muldaur, we already knew that William Shatner, Kate Mulgrew, Jonathan Frakes, you know, the usual crew is going to be there, and we've added five new names recently.
Yes, okay. So there's names other than Diana Muldaur. We have Colm Meaney, who, of course, was O'Brien. We have Anthony Montgomery, who was Travis Mayweather on Enterprise. Robert Duncan McNeil, who was Tom Paris on Voyager, and has actually turned into quite a seasoned director.
He has.
He's kind of gone on the same path of Jonathan Frakes, same way that Roxanne Dawson has as well, become quite a noted, especially TV director. And also, one of my favorite guest stars from DS9, Andrew Robinson, who was Garak, who...
Oh, absolutely.
Without Garak, DS9 would not have been the show it was. I love that character every time he shows up.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's interesting that you call him one of your favorite guest stars, because Deep Space Nine, there were, of course, there was like an extended cast of 20-something people, but there were a handful, like Garak and Rom, who... They're not in the opening credits as stars of the show, but you know, Garak is every bit as much a part of Deep Space Nine as Quark or anybody else, and one of my favorite characters too. He added so much richness to the Deep Space Nine storylines.
I mean, he must have been part of why Enterprise had a character like Shran on in later seasons. It's just you know, you get that new blood in you, and you get that different perspective on things. And of course, DS9 was filled with new perspectives, but Garak was this character that it felt like there could be a whole show just about Garak, you know, especially a prequel show, but even him, just, you know, his adventures on DS9 could be their own thing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, these are the people who are going to be coming, and there's, I'm sure the cast, I don't know, how many people do we have now? We have like, well, I don't know, 15 people maybe,
yeah,
who have already been confirmed, something, mm-hmm. something like that. You know, I'm sure this is, the ranks are going to grow and grow and grow as we head towards the August show, August 9th through 12th at the Rio, mm-hmm. once again. And Creation, they've already got, I think, gold passes, I think, are the ones that are already available. It could be something else now, too, if you keep an eye on their website, and we'll put a link in the show notes. If you want those premium packages, especially if you want the Latinum package so that you can get your own checkup from Dr. Pulaski, make sure that you are keeping your eye on Creation, because they're pricey, but nevertheless, they will sell out quickly.
Yes. Very good. Okay, so the next story on our list is something we've been talking about for a while on the show, which is the HD Next Generation sort of preview disc, I suppose you would call it.
Yeah.
And I guess they've released a little bit more footage in the form of a trailer. I guess, you know, half the trailer was what we've already seen, just the mm-hmm. the images of the reels being cleaned, and then that new remastered shot of the Enterprise moving away from camera. They also included a few other new shots, and you know, I was kind of let down by this, because most of the shots were just people sitting there, and
yeah.
and the unlike TOS, where the colors had become desaturated over time, TNG still looks pretty good. It still looks very fresh and new. It's the effect shots and the fact that there's not much detail. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of those regular shots in pristine 1080p. But on YouTube, it's just like, well, yes, that is what Q looks like when he's yelling at Picard.
Yeah. Now, did you watch it in HD, or did you just watch it on the page in YouTube? Did you pop it out to HD?
I bumped it up as high as I could, and it's still. Yeah. It's YouTube, so it's just not gonna blow me away. I'm still looking forward to seeing those things on the Blu-ray itself.
But the Blu-ray will be the thing.
The most interesting part was the remastered effects. Like, oh, the jellyfish from Farpoint looks fantastic.
Well, see, it's interesting because before we started recording, you were telling me that you're kind of disappointed in the trailer, and so now I see what you mean. The highlight of this trailer runs, I don't know, two and a half minutes or something, And the highlight of it is just this one tiny little
clip
where they show the jellyfish and they sweep across, you know, the original view, and they sweep across to the new view, which is incredible. Not just the jellyfish, but the soil on the planet, mm-hmm. you know, the detail that's in there. But I'm not sure. I mean, so in the original series, we truly got not remastered. Visual shots, but actually recreated visuals. I didn't get that impression here. What I got here was the impression that this is what it looked like on film originally, and this is what it looks like when they take that film and they clean it up and they do a new print of it, as opposed to them actually redoing the jelly. I don't think they're redoing the jellyfish. They're just, this is what you would have seen if they had the ability to deliver the original resolution that they shot.
So I've done a little bit of research into it to try to figure out exactly what's going on, because this, even on Twitter, we're still asked this every couple days by somebody, you know, what is actually going on with the HD remastered?
Yeah, right.
And okay, so the truth is somewhere in between. You're right that basically this is the original filmed elements, and they've recomposited them. So rather than the really archaic technique they used to combine the film elements in the 80s and 90s, they've used the best modern software to do pristine copies. It's like if you, it's hard to explain, but just if you just had a bunch of pieces of glass next to each other and then you videotaped it versus doing copy and paste from one Photoshop to a file to another, you know, you're just going to have a lot of loss in the information. Even if you're doing it state-of-the-art 1987, there's just so much detail lost. So they're being able to pull out a lot of the detail. But they're also going in and adding a little bit of detail as well. Certain things like the Enterprise D, if you look really closely, there's little people inside moving around. I think they've done little enhancements here and there just to make it a little bit better. But yeah. They're definitely not, from what I've seen, recreating the whole shots. They definitely won't be doing anything like the computer generated right. Enterprise D we saw yeah. in These Are the Voyages.
Right, like completely redoing the exterior right. scene to really change the show. I think that's what a lot of fans are worried about, that yeah. that they're going to like reimagine Star Trek: The Next Generation like they kind of did it with the original mm-hmm. series episodes. So, although I don't think they were heavy-handed too much in the original series, though.
Yeah.
It's not like George Lucas, you know, like actually removing actors and putting new actors in their place right. and that kind of right. thing.
Now this looks like they're coming at it from a completely different perspective than the people who did the TOS remastering, where they're yeah. saying, look, the effects artists did a really good job. They were just hampered by a lot of it is just the compositing, and they were hampered yeah. by what they were limited by as far as the detail they could get in there. And also they knew it was only going to be shown on TV, so they didn't do tiny right. details. So we're just exactly. going to make it just this much better, and it makes a huge difference, as we see in that jellyfish shot you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as I've been telling people, I think that the primary reason for doing this is because in order for The Next Generation to continue to be shown in syndication in the future, it has to be in HD, because networks are not going to broadcast SD content anymore. Yeah. And they can't just leave this the way it is, because if they do, we're not going to see The Next Generation on television anymore. It's not about trying to sell you new box sets so that they can make money again selling you what you've already bought before. It's right. not even about putting it on Blu-ray, I don't think. I think it's about making it, bringing it up to spec so that it can continue to be syndicated and be shown to everyone mm-hmm. in the future, is what it's yeah. really about. And so I think they're going to add detail, like you said, where it makes sense to, like showing people walking around in the windows mm-hmm. of the Enterprise. I don't think you're going to see any massive reimagining of any shots here. And I think that if you take screen stills, like go to TrekCore and look at their collections of screen stills from The Next Generation, they're awful. And yeah. and it's not anything to do with TrekCore whatsoever. They do a right. wonderful job. They're awful because even coming from DVD, everything is so soft. All mm-hmm. the details are so soft. And that's what it is, because, again, like you said, they knew it was only going to be shown on television in SD, and also the technology that they had to make the prints. And so this is going to bring everything to life for us, I think. I'm personally really excited about seeing this. And as for the trailer, I agree with you. What I would have liked to have seen would be more of these sweeps where they show yeah. this is what the original, like when they show Kronos, yeah. I would have liked to have seen them sweep across there, because you can tell that you can see like a light flashes mm-hmm. off the buildings that maybe you weren't quite as vibrant before.
Right.
Sweep across that would have been nice.
I mean, I think what they needed too was to have interviews with the people actually working on it and explaining the process, explaining what they're really doing. I have a really big problem with Star Trek announcer guy that they always use in these videos.
I know. I don't like Star Trek announcer guy either.
So I just
coming
think
soon to Blu-ray.
Right.
Star Trek, like you've never seen it before. It's Star Trek, the next level.
Picard plays a flute.
I know. Listen to how much more vibrant the flute is when played in
7.1. 7.1 right. surround sound flute action.
We know your computer does not have 7.1, but we're going to spend most of our trailer on the flute.
Exactly.
I know.
So I just think they need to rethink how they're doing this. And probably when they actually do the full first season set, they'll think about how they're going to promote it. This is just a early thing for fans. I don't think they're going to throw their full weight behind promoting what's essentially a disc that's just to promote something coming out later on.
Well, I'm really looking forward to see it. I already pre-ordered it, actually. It came up on Amazon Japan, I think about a week ago, and mm-hmm. I ordered it. It was like 2,200 yen. It's cheaper than I thought it was going to be. And its release date, I think, for the US is January 31st, and then it was like February second, I think, over here.
Yeah. So I'll definitely pick it up, and we'll definitely talk about it on the show. I'm really especially looking forward to shots of the jellyfish and shots of Kronos. And it will be interesting to see, you know, details of stuff in those live action shots, like exactly what gauge was used when knitting Wesley's amazing Technicolor sweater.
For sure, because I've been wanting to make my own, but without knowing those kind of details, I mean, the best I could hope for is like, you know, a second-rate replica.
Right. You wouldn't want that.
No. All right. Well, why don't we move on and talk a little bit more about Five Year Mission, as we are doing each week right now. We're previewing a couple of tracks from their new album, Year 2, which is just right on the verge of release now, just a few more weeks to go before you'll be able to get your hands on this album. So the first track we'll look at this week is Court Martial. Let's play a little clip.
It all began when we were younger. We had become friends. Then came that day that I forgot that switch. That's when the friendship ends.
So this is from Year 2's Country Years, I'm assuming.
Yeah, right.
No, but it's good. I like the take they took on this. We were talking before the show, and these aren't episodes that I remember especially well for some reason. But we were realizing that this song is from the point of view of the supposed dead man, which is not what you would assume, especially for an episode about this guy who's supposed to be dead for the whole thing.
Yeah, right. It's what I love when Five Year Mission does this, when they look at the episode from the perspective of not who you would think it would be. I mean, here you would think it would be Kirk, because he's being court-martialed for the alleged murder through criminal negligence of one of his officers. You know, or maybe you might hear it through the eyes of McCoy or Spock, for example, and you're talking about Kirk. But instead, we get the story through the eyes of Finney, who everyone thinks is dead. And spoiler alert for this episode from the late 1960s, Finney's not actually dead. But the style of this song, because it's a heavy subject, you know, here's Kirk. He's on trial for criminal negligence resulting in the death of a subordinate. And yet we've got this, like, upbeat, you know, country song going on.
Exactly.
It just it cracks me up.
It's great. All right, so why don't we go ahead and preview the next song, which is, The Return of the Archons, which, of course, is the second episode in the Archons arc on TOS. One of those epic arcs, the multi-season continuity.
Yeah, you know, actually, I think you're mistaken there, because there's the first season episode just simply called Archons.
Archons,
and then,
right.
But in between here, there was also the one, The Departure of the Archons.
Oh, yes. How could I forget?
You know, well, it's easy to forget those middle stories sometimes. And then we get, you know, the conclusion and the return of the Archons.
Right.
All right. So why don't we play a little clip of this? So, Greg, you may remember this episode as being the one with the zombie monks who come at you with these long rods, and then there's Landru, and basically it's kind of like a culture that had a lot of conflict, and then this leader Landru came and he pulled them out of that, kind of purging personality. I mean, it's really like a zombie, like, culture. Everyone just kind of walks around in a daze all the time, except at midnight there's the red hour, the festival, and everyone goes crazy and their emotions come out and they like destroy the town, and then in the morning everything's, you know, back to normal again, and they
it's
a very
one of
interesting
those,
episode actually.
It's one of those ones where you go to a planet and there's really weird stuff going on, and basically you have to figure out who's leading the society and stop them, because obviously this is not the way anyone should be living. It's not a bad trope, but it is definitely something that TOS did quite a bit. So
yes,
what did you think of what 5-Year Mission did with it?
Well, I love what they did with it because, again, it is this kind of, again, it's another social message, and it's another case, you know, of Kirk essentially violating the Prime Directive by destroying the computer that runs the society because he doesn't agree with what's going on the planet. You get a lot of that in the original series as well. But what I like here is that it's all about the festival. You know, here in Japan, we have a lot of festivals throughout the year, and you know, the whole town prepares for the festival. Then you have like a day or two of not destroying the city, but you have a day or two of, you know, dancing, traditional dances, parades, all kinds of cultural activities. And it's a big festival. And here, the song is very, you know, it's upbeat, and it's about the festival. And it has one of my favorite lines in here where they say, "We're up for the red hour, baby."
Yes, it's perfect.
I hate to say this about all the songs on this album, but probably one of my favorite tracks. It's amongst my favorite tracks.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I really need to go back and watch this part of TOS right after Year Two is released. Is my plan to start watching these, and then I'll listen to the songs along with watching. And I always look forward to doing that. But just listening to the tracks and sort of getting used to the sounds of it, the court martial really stood out to me as being crazy with this sort of country twang to it. And then the Archons, where it's all about the Red Hour, is just fantastic. And so, yeah.
These two tracks side by side are great examples of that diversity of style that we've talked about over the past few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think if they were simply laying out the tracks in an order that made sense musically or stylistically, they wouldn't have put these next to each other. But because that's how the episode order came down, you know, that's what they do on the CD, and that's one thing I love about 5-Year Mission.
Oh, for sure. So we'll be previewing some more tracks next week, and we're actually going to have 5-Year Mission on the show coming up, and they're going to do some acoustic performances for everyone, so be sure to tune in to that one. It's going to be, I really, really look forward to that for sure.
Definitely.
What I'm not looking forward to is if I were to ever find myself having to live out my life amongst the Packlids. And... Greg, did you see this blog post? There's a guest blogger named Jordan Hoffman on StarTrek.com with a new blog called One Trek Mind. And he listed out the Star Trek's 10 least threatening villains.
It's an interesting list. And obviously, some of the ones he picked out are kind of obvious and perfect. The Packlids, the Edo, which... I guess the Edos qualify as villains because they were going to kill Wesley. Obviously, most Star Trek fans at the time didn't have much of a problem with Wesley being killed, but in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and Riker was like, sure, you can have the boy if you let me hang out here.
Right, and the Ferengi, you know, from The Last Outpost, of course, not very threatening at all.
Yeah.
But there's a few really missing on here, and a few of them I'm not sure that I agree with.
All right. Well, let's go through them real quick, and then you tell me who you think's missing.
Sure.
So number 10, the Packlids, who apparently in the original teleplay were called the Duhs, which makes perfect sense to me.
Yes.
You've got the Emorgs, who are the hot space babes from Spock's brain. Mm-hmm. You've got the Wide Eye from Move Along Home. And I like what Jordan says here. He says, you'd think that a mullet, a love for tabletop games, and access to a pocket universe would be a recipe for a fearsome foe. But you'd be mistaken. Which is a good one. Next is the Edo, who you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. He calls them the pheromone-fueled lust beings from the TNG episode Justice, who are unable to keep their hands off one another. And when they aren't jogging, they are fornicating or playing Ultimate Frisbee. And number 6, I like this choice, the automated repair station from the Enterprise episode Dead Stop.
Which, okay.
He calls nothing more than a haunted conveyor car wash.
Oh, man. Them's are some fighting words. That's what those
all
are.
All right. Number five is Tier Mob, who is from Friday's Child, if you remember that episode of the original series. It's one I kind of tend to not remember so well. He says you just can't take Tier Mob seriously because he looks too much like Will Ferrell.
Right.
And then he says, you stay classy, Capella 4.
Yeah.
And number four, Armus, who axed Tasha Yar. Number three, the telepathic pitcher plant from the Voyager episode Bliss. And number two was Commander Krug from The Search for Spock, who I think is probably the same problem I've always had with Commander Krug, is that it's just kind of hard to take Christopher Lloyd seriously as a villain.
I can see that.
And number one, I think it goes without saying, the first Ferengi that we saw in The Last Outpost.
Yes.
All right, so what are your thoughts?
It is a good list. If you're going to pick a least threatening Klingon villain from a TOS film, I really don't think that Krug is the one you go for.
I know what you're going to say.
It's just that Commander, Captain, whatever he was, Claw. He did nothing in the entire film. He wasn't played by Christopher Lloyd, but he he did a lot of threatening and no actual actioning. And
yeah, I thought for sure you were going to go with the whale probe, but if you have to
pick a Klingon.
Okay. If you had to pick a Klingon. Okay.
Right.
So if you pick any villain from a TOS film, it's the whale probe.
Probably the whale probe.
The thing is that the whale probe actually did almost throw the entire planet Earth into an ice age.
It's kind of astonishing.
Yeah. Whereas Claw, as you said, basically did nothing at all except look through a periscope, which again, I don't know why you need on a starship. Yeah. And
he was at a Twisted Sister concert.
Yeah.
But that's not very threatening either.
Right. So actually, you're right. It's Claw.
Claw. Okay. Yeah. The other one that's missing is any Kazon, and maybe it's just that he couldn't even think of the name of a single Kazon villain to put on the list.
Yeah. Yeah, the Kazon should certainly be on here. I think I'd have to go back and read to be sure. I think he may have mentioned Kazon in the introduction before getting into the list.
Okay.
I don't recall, but yeah, they are by far the most vanilla, unimaginative villains on Voyager,
right?
For sure.
And then there are, of course, the bad guys in quotes from the Outrageous Okana with the lasers.
That's right. I don't even remember their names anymore. Laser guys.
The laser guys.
Laser cats. Actually, that would have been cool if laser cats had locked onto the Enterprise.
Oh, well, have you seen the Twitter account for the 8th season of Next Gen?
Yeah.
I think laser cats should definitely be one of those. We'll have to make sure we put that in the show notes.
Yeah, let's put a link to that, everyone. If you're not following them yet, follow these guys. They tweet plots from the missing 8th season of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Really fantastic. I saw Will Wheaton retweeting them the other day, and I just had to start following. So
yeah, I've been following them for a while.
So what did you think of the list?
Now, well, you said that the automated repair station is fighting words. So tell me why.
Haunted conveyor car wash? I mean, wow. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. A haunted conveyor car wash might be pretty scary. I love Dead Stop, and he even admits that it's a pretty great concept for an episode.
Yeah, he does. He does, yeah.
So
it's an unusual villain.
That's true.
You don't often have a repair station as a villain.
That's true. But, you know, it's sort of going back to TOS with evil computers who are trying to take over the Enterprise or do something or another. I really like the idea of an evil AI who's just looking to scrap the ship for parts. And especially if that AI can be played by Roxanne Dawson, who I must mention at least 4 times in every episode.
Yeah, it's a good thing that we don't do this as video, so people cannot see the wall behind you where you have, like, it's kind of spooky, all these pinups of Roxanne Dawson everywhere, but...
Roxanne, you don't have to turn on the... Anyway.
Warp core. All right.
Exactly.
I thought the list was good. Obviously, there's some stuff missing. I mean, you can't limit yourself to 10 if you're going to talk about the least threatening villains in Star Trek. I like what he said about the telepathic pitcher plant from Bliss, where he says that it was actually a fairly well-rendered metaphor for the dangers of forcing a solution where one does not exist.
Right.
And then young Naomi Wildman started calling it by this name, and somebody's got to tell that kid that branding is important. So I like this article. It's very amusing. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what Jordan Hoffman does with the future One Track Mind blogs. I don't know, you know, who I would add, really. I think the Paclids are a given on here. The Ferengi are a given. Some of them I don't really consider villains. I mean, like the Ito. I guess technically they are, but there's just so many. I mean, what about the guys in Code of Honor who wear... MC Hammer pants and fight Tasha. There's so many fun, non-threatening villains in Star Trek.
Well, you know, sometimes the story can't always be about how they face, you know, terrible odds. Sometimes the story has to be about the best way to deal with people that are actually kind of silly. And especially Next Gen, really like those silly people that Picard just had to reason with and make them understand why they need to be just a little more enlightened and stop threatening us so much.
Right. But at the end of the day, Picard would turn around and fly away, whereas Kirk would blow up their planetary computer.
Right.
And then say, it would be great to come back here, you know, 100 years from now and see how this all turned out. Oh, gosh. Well, anyway, we'll put a link to this in the show notes so everyone can go and read this list for yourself over on StarTrek.com. And, Greg, speaking of finding out how things may have turned out, let's quickly mention some comics coming up in February from IDW, including number 6 from the ongoing series.
Yep. I mean, still waiting for Galileo 7, part 1, which should be coming out this week. I'm very much looking forward to it and talking about it on next week's show. So the next 2 will be Galileo 7, and then episodes or issues 5 and 6 will be Operation Annihilate, which I know you love because of the exclamation mark.
That's
in the title.
Right. It's the only episode of the original series with an exclamation point in the title. And Greg, what is the only other episode of any Star Trek series with an exclamation point in the title? 450 points and the win.
Oh, shoot. Actually, I don't know this one. What was the other one?
It's Bride of Chaotica.
Oh, yes.
Voyager.
Bride of Chaotica.
Oh, man. Now you let PMS win.
Shoot.
I thought AA was going to win. All right. That is a Big Bang Theory reference for anyone
who
thinks I'm just making a joke in very poor taste here.
Which you may still be, but it is a Big Bang Theory reference.
Well, it was funny that they didn't get... They thought AA was a bad abbreviation,
right,
but they didn't get that perpetual motion machine. Or perpetual motion system, is that what it was called?
Right, that was it.
Is an even worse acronym. So anyway, you know, it's... Like you said, you're still waiting for Galileo 7. That's the hard thing about this is you constantly have news coming out about IDW comics coming up, and yet we still don't even have number 3 yet, and we're talking about number 6. So, but we have talked about 3 and 4 in the Galileo 7 in the past, so I did want to talk a little bit here about 5 and 6 coming up, and Operation Annihilate, and what your thoughts are on where they might go or where you want to see them go in reimagining this.
Yeah, wow. I don't even actually know what to say about that. I'm really looking forward to seeing the changes to Galileo 7, the plot line there, and it's going to be a matter of just seeing what they're doing. I felt like the first issue, I don't know if they were trying to not alienate fans too fast, or if just they couldn't figure out much different to do with the story. It's possible we're just going to see the setup, like issue 1, be very close to the original episode, and then part 2 is going to be a very different spin on things. That's possibly the way they'll be going. Or the first issue of Galileo 7 might be this completely different setup and just vaguely be similar to the episode we remember. So it's really going to be a matter of just seeing what it is. And I really wish that issue 6 weren't so far away. You know, release one every couple weeks. You know, it doesn't have to be every week, but I don't know.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could get them like, you know, every 2 weeks or something. Yeah. But obviously, it takes a lot of work to put these things together. So it's maybe not a practical thing. But yeah, you might be right in terms of why they played things fairly straight with where No Man Has Gone Before. The little bit what it said here about number 6, of course, mm-hmm. I guess we would find this out in number 5 if we could get our hands on
right,
it.
Right, exactly.
that Kirk and his estranged brother join forces to forestall the extinction of a colony. Whereas in the original episode, they arrive at the Deneva colony, which has been attacked by these like a giant amoebas, and mm-hmm. this mass insanity has gone, and they find Kirk's brother Sam dead.
Right.
And then here Kirk is going to join forces with his brother, his estranged brother. And they're not estranged in the original either. I got the feeling that Kirk, of course, they don't see each other often because Kirk's out, you know, romancing women around the mm-hmm. galaxy and taking part in gladiator battles and things like that. But
right.
But I felt that he, you know, had a close relationship with his brother in the original series telling of the story.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting to see. Obviously, a father dying really early on can have a huge effect on a family. Although I did...
Yeah, a good point.
I did feel like the way that JJ played it, Kirk didn't have a brother. I mean, originally in the script, there was that kid on the road who was going to be his brother. And there are scenes, but they sort of changed it and turned that into a friend of his. And I really thought they were going to go down the route of just ignoring the character of Sam in general.
Although in the scenes where Kirk is driving the car in Iowa, is that not mm-hmm. his brother that he passes
no,
on the road?
No, they actually dub him saying, hey, Johnny, which Johnny isn't.
Okay.
Johnny becomes, that was his brother originally, but because because they changed it and took out those earlier scenes, they decided to just make it a lot simpler and have it just be a friend of his.
I see. Well, it would be easy to play it as, well, he has an older brother that he can talk about, except that it's quite clear at the beginning of JJ's movie that that's the first child, I think.
I feel like it really
emotionally,
is.
Emotionally,
yeah?
It really feels that way. So it would have to be a half-brother.
I'm thinking that must be the deal. That I mean, maybe they'll play it that... now I'm forgetting the actor's name who played the voice on Kirk's radio as he was driving the car.
I don't remember that either. Yeah,
Greg from Heroes. But maybe they'll write it that was a stepfather and that they him and Kirk's mother had another kid, and this would be the Sam in Operation Annihilate. I'm sure this will all come out in January when we finally get our hands
we'll
on issue 5.
Right, and when we're reporting about, you know, issue 12 on the show here, right?
Right, exactly.
All right. Well, looking forward to seeing how it all turns out.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start to head out of news here and get over to our feature. One last thing I wanted to just mention, a quick little pitch here as we close out news today, is that we're starting a new show on Trek FM. This new show is called Matter Stream, and it's shorter than The Ready Room, you know, about 40 minutes or so. And what we're going to be doing on MatterStream is we're going to be talking to the people involved in Star Trek and the people who have been influenced by Star Trek about the bigger picture, about issues related to Star Trek or inspired, you know, science, social issues, things like that. And the first show is going to be coming out right around the time that this episode of The Radio Room comes out here. I'm working on editing the first episode now. And I sat down recently with Rod Roddenberry for this first show. And we talked about the Roddenberry Foundation quite extensively. And also we talked a little bit about Trek Nation and his experiences making the documentary over the years. So just watch for that show coming up. Of course, we'll let you know when it's out on Twitter and you'll see it on the site and it'll be in iTunes. And I hope everyone's going to enjoy this kind of different take on Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I can't wait to hear that interview.
It was great. Rod was just absolutely wonderful to talk to. Star Trek has always been prophetic of the future, but few episodes have been as prophetic of what's happening today as Deep Space Nine's past tense. And today we're going to talk about past tense, and of course I have Greg with me, and also we're very excited to be joined at long last by Tristan Riddell, host of Hyper Channel on Trek FM. How are you, Tristan?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
We are doing good. Pretty well, thanks.
Glad to be here, finally.
Yeah, at last, we got you. So since we have you here, before we talk about Star Trek, I wanted to ask you what you thought about how the NFL playoffs are shaping up there, Tristan.
How are my Seahawks?
Why you got to do that to me, man? Why do you got to do that to me? For those of you who don't know, I work in football. And if you knew me personally, you know that that's God's cruel joke on my career because I went in for TV and film and I wound up in sports editing. Like I did a football documentary that won some awards, got nominated for an Emmy, and then U.S. Soccer found my resume, worked for them for a couple of years, and now I'm working for a magazine and who kind of branched off, did a TV show and a web series. And Chris, you always dog me. They're like, hey, how do you think this is gonna go? How do you think this goes? Like, listen, I was the geeky nerd in high school who loved Star Trek. And was the shame of my family that was filled with football players and mechanics and everything like that. And I don't know how an engine runs, and I don't know how to spiral a pigskin. You should just be thankful that I know that it's called a pigskin. So,
yeah.
Well, to answer your question, I think Green Bay's going to go all the way.
Oh yeah, Green Bay's 9-0 right now. I know nothing about football, but I think that's impressive.
Yeah, that's usually impressive. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Tristan. I just had to do that to you because the other day you tweeted that your family just wants to talk to you about football all the time. So.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, people who barely even know me, when they find out that I work in football, they just need to come up to me and ask me. So like, what are the Bears doing? Like, you think Color can make it? Do you think he just has the arm for it, or some crap like that? And or they'll talk to me about like my alma mater, who barely has a football program, and they'll start giving me play by plays, and I'm like, "Listen, buddy, I know about like half of what you're saying."
You should just tell them that.
Thankful.
We'll be good when we get Worf as a linebacker.
Exactly, right? But then there's just going to be so much drama because he's going to start snapping kids' necks left and right, like he did on the pitch.
And then I feel sorry for the coach when they win and they douse him with prune juice.
Well, maybe Tristan, you can answer me, which team was better, the 98 Yankees or the 2015 London Kings?
Well, the 98 Yankees, the 2015 Kings is really where it's at. I mean, but the 98 Yankees is where it was the prelude to the 99 Yankees.
Maybe, but I think the Niners could take the Kings, so
that no depends question about if Rom is bunting or not.
true. All right. Well, why don't we jump back over to Star Trek proper a little bit and talk about past tense. So past tense, this has always been one of my favorite Deep Space Nine episodes for sure. And I've watched it, I don't know how many times over the years. And I rewatched it going into preparation for today's show here. And, I have to say, in light of things that are going on in the world right now, that this episode just kind of struck me in a completely different way, more powerful way anyway, than it has in the past. And it's amazing that you have these shows, you know, like the crime shows, detective shows, where the stories are like ripped from today's headline. I mean, there was one show back in the 90s, I think, that proudly proclaimed in all of their commercials that ripped from the headlines. And this episode of Deep Space Nine, I mean, if they wrote this and aired it today, you would exactly think that. But it was actually written, what, 15, 16 years ago. Greg, what were your feelings? I know you've seen it before and now you've watched it again. What are your feelings about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to your point about ripped from the headlines, this episode was released in 95. And, you know, that was sort of booming years for the U.S. economy.
Yeah, exactly.
There may have been a homeless problem. There may have been some unemployment, but things were actually looking up for America in 1995. And it's really interesting that they foresaw this sort of downturn. And obviously leading into today, yeah, if this episode aired today as a new thing, everyone would say, oh, well, it's obviously trying to make a direct statement on what's going on now. So I do find that quite interesting. One of the writers on, I believe it was part two, is Rene Echevarria, who works on Terra Nova. And there's another show that sort of looks at the future in a very bleak way, you know, saying that we're going to completely ruin our environment, and they don't really have a solution for it other than go back in time. But it's interesting. Yes. Oh, dear.
Oh, can you think of a better solution? I mean, that's usually my go-to button.
No, that totally works. That totally works.
Yeah.
But no.
That's what Greg would do, I know.
Right now, we're getting all of this environmental disaster, economic disaster stuff. And it's interesting to see something back from the 90s that was really looking into it really deeply. And it at this point, yeah, I mean, it does look pretty prophetic. Although there was that one line where Bashir says that by the mid-2020s, there's a camp like this in every major city in America. And they're talking about the sort of concentration camps for the homeless and unemployed. And obviously, there's a parallel to be drawn between that and Occupy today. Although we were talking before the show, the main difference being they're voluntary and they're protest movements. But it's the same sort of thing where there's this growing movement of people who are very dissatisfied with the status quo. And there are other people, like the sort of Bill Gates character that Jadzia befriends, who are kind of ambivalent to it. They kind of know what's happening, but they aren't interested in worrying about it or changing it.
Yeah, even one of the people at the party that that Jadzia was at, like, you know, I think one of the gentlemen said, like, you know, you're out there, you know, with no ID. I'm surprised you didn't wind up in one of those sanctuaries. And the other person said, I thought they stopped doing that. You know, seriously, like one in every major city. And you're going to say, I thought they stopped doing that. But like at first when I heard that, I was like, you know, how could you be so ignorant of the times? But then, you know, I'm talking to some friends of mine and I said, I was like, hey, did you hear about, you know, like when like Occupy was first starting, I was like, did you hear about that girl that got maced for no reason? Mm-hmm. And they're like, what are you talking about? I was like, well, have you heard about Occupy Wall Street? And they're like, no, what is it? And I was like, holy crap. You know, just how could you not know? I mean,
obviously
by that
not
time,
on Twitter.
Obviously. you can't not hear about it if you have a Twitter feed.
I mean, but there's an Occupy everywhere. I mean, I'm in Seattle, so obviously there's an Occupy Seattle, but I mean, there's a Occupy Lancaster, Pennsylvania. There's an Occupy Dover, you know, every small town in America,
I think there's
sort of Occupy movement.
There's an Occupy Lickskillet, Alabama, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Occupy.
That's
Perunk.
Totally where the man lives.
Yeah, that's totally. The headquarters right there in Lickskillet.
Yeah, that's where the decisions happen. Like whenever somebody says, you know, the powers that be, they're talking about that town.
Right. I don't want to make this be the Occupy show. I do want to point out that, I mean, there is a point to be made and there are people who are quite angry about it. And I just, you know, I don't know. Is there a big problem right now? Do you guys think, just, you know, briefly, is there a big problem with unemployment in America? And is there a problem with a certain group sort of controlling everything to the extent that Star Trek is showing?
I thought we were doing the Ready Room. Is this Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader?
Yeah, I felt like that was kind of a loaded question. Like, you know, like, do we have a problem in unemployment, Tristan and Chris? I mean, are you reading the news?
Is the dollar weak?
Well, yeah. I mean, okay, I guess my point is past tense paints a very, very bleak future.
Yeah.
And I do you feel like we're headed down a path to this future, or is it...
Yeah.
Okay. Do you see it being, you know, 10 years and we're doing this?
I mean, the timeline... Well, you know, I was thinking about that earlier, and the timeline... This is what, 2027?
I think that's right.
Is that right? 2024.
No, it's 2024.
Yeah.
There we go.
So 13 years from now. Mm-hmm. So August 30th, 2024. So 13 years from now. You know, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about maybe we're closer to it than this portrays, because I obviously the unemployment situation is very, very bad. I mean, in some states, it's much worse than others. It's to the point that's almost unthinkable in a country like the United States. And there's obviously, I think the core, what we don't get in past tense is we don't find out all the events that led to all these people being in the sanctuary district and the wall being around the sanctuary district. So we don't know about that. But what we do see is that we see people who have been thrown into the sanctuary district, and they seem to have no will left to try to improve their situation until we get the character there who was, what was the name of the man who they that Sisko befriends, who helps him get the gimmies in?
Oh, yeah, that was...
Not BC, was what was his name?
Was that Preston? Webb.
Was Preston the...
Yeah, Webb. Preston. Webb is the, the
Webb.
Guy, right?
Webb
is
the guy.
You see Webb kind of rise up in the episode, and he says, you know, what we need to do, we have to show a good face. We have to get word out that we want to find jobs. We want to improve our situation. And so I think that's where they kind of got a voice. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, they got that voice at the same time that the riots started. So if they had had that voice sooner, you know, maybe the riots may not have happened. I don't know. Maybe they wouldn't have been thrown inside these walls. I don't know.
Yeah. An interesting thing that the show hints at, and, you know, reading Memory Alpha, one of the writers said that this is definitely something they were doing, was to show how Bashir and Sisko were treated as opposed to a beautiful white woman like Jadzia. Yeah. That the people in the sanctuary are those that society doesn't care about as much. And it kind of, I mean, that's something I can't believe Star Trek's really touching on it that strongly, but that's kind of what it's saying is Webb isn't most of the people in there. You know, if it all was people like Webb wearing suits and clean shaven and combing their hair, then maybe this wouldn't have happened. But because it's a segment of the society that most people want to ignore, it just gets ignored.
So in that way, it's not exactly a parallel to Occupy. It's also a lot about, say, a homeless problem where, you know, you have cities who want to outlaw homelessness, who, you know, want to round up homelessness, throw them somewhere where you can't see them.
Yeah.
And then it's mixed with the problem of unemployment.
Right.
What about you, Tristan? What do you think we're headed towards or how does it parallel?
Well, you know, Whenever I watch, I feel like sci-fi has the ability to showcase the road that we're going on. You know, like if trends continue, and if, you know, if somebody, you know, writes a story or makes a movie or makes a statement or, you know, in some fashion that can kind of show us the road that we're on, because most of the times we don't know the road we're on until we're already there. And I feel like this is that kind of the episode that shows us, you know, where we're going and how we can step off or turn right or turn left. So I think that's why I enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed the message. I think there was a lot of things technically wrong with it. I felt like it could have probably been one episode instead of two. But I liked what Greg said about how they show the difference in treatment towards Sisko and Bashir as opposed to Jadzia because of, you know, the way they look. You got a Middle Eastern, a black guy, and a white woman. You know, who's going to get treated nicer? But at the same time, on the same token, Jadzia was way smarter than Sisko and Bashir because, you know, you'd think that these Starfleet officers would be trained, you know, with all the crap that Kirk did, You know, with all the time shifting, you'd think that there would be temporal basic training because, you know, Sisko and Bashir wake up. They're like, oh, what year is it? What's going on?
I know, I that mean, line
you
is
look
like,
familiar.
What
and then
year is this?
Yeah, I mean, everybody who goes back in time, they wake up to Sorrento. They're like, oh, God, I need to find a newspaper, you know?
Yeah, right.
And but with Jadzia, she's like, oh, I was with my friends. Yeah, they absolutely took my ID, and I know exactly what you mean when they say that when they must have taken my ID. Thank goodness they didn't take my brooch.
They
took
my brooch. You know, Sisko would have said, oh my gosh, my communicator pin that lets me talk with my spaceship is gone.
So I
yeah.
Exactly. So I didn't really feel that bad for Sisko and Bashir when I found out that Jadzia was a smarter one. It was like, no wonder she made it to the high class parties and got the 1990s terminal.
That's because she has the computer. Cool tattoos from Japan.
Exactly.
Yes. Oh dear.
I'm surprised that everybody in Japan doesn't have those. I mean, isn't that right, Chris? I mean, doesn't everybody in Japan have those?
Yeah, it's just a waiting list. I'm supposed to get mine on Wednesday, so
okay.
Next show, you can check them out.
Oh, nice. I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah. All right.
Well, maybe we can get to the episode proper. And I want to talk a little bit about the setup where they're just randomly flying to Earth. I guess I don't have a big problem with this.
No,
they're flying to Earth for a meeting.
Yeah, for a meeting. Yeah.
Right. Sort of like last week where Archer has to make a speech. Now, Sisko has to go to a meeting, so they fly back to Earth.
Oh, that's right.
And
but at least O'Brien didn't kill himself so that Sisko wouldn't be late.
Thank God. All right. So then there's a transporter malfunction that sends them back in time. Now on the scale of ways people are sent back in time on Star Trek, how does this rank up for you guys?
Ooh.
Well,
transporter malfunction.
Well, I love the slingshot around the sun. I mean, that has to be my favorite.
Oh, yes. That's
slingshot
awesome.
Around the sun.
I don't know. This is kind of the classic way. Transporter malfunction. This is like the easy way. Transporter malfunction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is when the writers and producers write down technobabble. Like literally the word technobabble in the script. And then
Teching
they say,
the
oh, well, screw it. You know, just transporter. You know, they just throw a dart on the wall and it hits transporter. You're like, okay, that's the catalyst. That's our plot device.
You know, what I liked in here, though, was that every time that O'Brien starts explaining to Kira what's going on, Kira's face just, like, glazes over, and her eyes bulge out, and she's, like, looking at him like, so what does that mean? You know, she's like...
Which is pretty much me as I was watching the show
means,
as well.
You know? Just tell me, like, they got lost in time.
Right.
That's like...
Yeah.
Well, the way I was thinking of this episode is a lot like Sitting on the Edge of Forever. But that show had such a simple, let's just put them through a portal, and now they're in the past, and the whole episode's in the past, and then pull them back out of the portal, and we're done. Whereas this episode had this whole B story where we're trying to figure out how they got sent back in time, what we can do to find them, the chronoton particles that got caught in the exhaust pipe, all these things.
I feel like there could be a happy medium in between, you know, the Deus Ex Machina and the, you know, the techno babble. I feel like in between is where we need to meet. But that's funny that you bring up City on the Edge of Forever. Did anybody else notice the boxing poster on the back of the Jazz
Club?
I read about that.
It's there, a reference. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a reference to City on the Edge of Forever because the writers put that in. The producers put that in specifically because they wanted you to think that Kira and O'Brien were in the same, you know, same town at the same time as Kirk, Spock, and Bones.
That like, was a popular like year.
For some reason, that's just a temporal hotspot.
Right.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's a cool idea.
You know, talking about all the techno babble, one thing I do notice in here too, though, is that I don't think anyone in Star Trek delivers techno babble better than Cole Meany does.
Oh, yeah.
It's just so calm and cool. Like it all means something to him, and he just rattles it off. But talk about how they get back in time. I mean, do you buy the concept of some ancient civilization that's long gone built a gateway that can send you to any time in the past, more so than the fact that chroniton particles get caught in the ablative armor because of the Romulan cloaking device? I mean, for me, the Guardian of Forever is actually easier to swallow than the whole a Blade of Armor chroniton particle explanation here.
I buy the Guardian of Forever just because it's taken like at face value.
Yeah, it's just what they spend so much time in this episode digging
into it. We talk about on we don't have Brian Finifter with us from Down in Front, but they talk about the magic bean of being that thing you just sort of accept and then you move on in a story. Yeah. And then I call this digging up the magic bean, where you dig into it so much and you try to figure out like why the magic bean does what it does and what it is, and you end up ruining it. You end up, you know, the plant isn't going to grow because you spent so much time focused on it.
Actually, you know, Greg, it's, as you know from living in Japan, we have the tradition once a year where we throw the beans at the demon, you know, coming in the door. Yeah. It's like throwing the beans. The demon is the cause of the malfunction, and O'Brien's just throwing the beans at it, right?
Except here it's throwing it at the view screen. You just throw the beans at the viewing screen.
Yeah.
I think what you nailed on the head is basically the difference between Star Wars and Star Trek, and you know, sci-fi fantasy and you know, I mean, science fantasy and science fiction. You know, it's you know, Star Trek focuses heavily on how things work and why they work. And, you know, with Star Wars, things just are. Things just do. Right. Like, you don't care how a lightsaber works. It's just awesome when you turn it on.
Right.
But, you know, when you have something like a Blade of Armor or Chronotons, like, I personally want to know how that works, and I like it when they use that stuff. But, you know, when it starts getting so technical that, my Windows, you know, PC driver won't work with my HP printer because I have a Dilbert, you know, screensaver. Right. That's basically what they just told us.
Maybe that was the problem. Does O'Brien have a Dilbert screensaver in engineering?
He
on the
seems
Defiant?
Like a Dilbert fan, you know.
Yeah, I think
you
that's
know,
the
I'd
problem.
Say, I'd and, say he uses that.
And ROM is Wally.
Right. It's that the 2024 storyline is so interesting, and the things that all three of them are doing is just fascinating, and we have to keep cutting. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we have to keep cutting back to O'Brien and find out just a tiny, minuscule thing to advance the silly plot forward on that end.
So, okay, so going to the 2024 storyline now, if we could recapture some of this time, I think a little bit of the technobabble at the beginning is necessary just so we know, well, okay, there's something happened and they got there. But then as the episode goes on and they spend so much time trying to figure it out, look for them, if we could take that time and put it all in the 2024 time period, what kind of things did you feel that you wanted to see that were maybe missing that would have furthered the whole story of the Bell Riots and the people in the Sanctuary District and how this influences the future of the development of the Federation?
I think seeing things outside of the wall would have been nice. I felt like as an audience member, we were trapped in there with them, and maybe that's what the producers were going for. But at the same time, I wanted to see what life was like outside. Now, granted, it'd be a lot more time, a lot more money, when it all barrels down to. But I would have liked to, and I feel like at the party with the rich guy with Brenner, that kind of showcased the indifference of people, or the hoity-toity. Oh, well, you know, I have money, so I don't care about people who don't.
Right.
Kind of sensibility. But I wanted to see maybe, you know, people's families outside, like people petitioning, people trying to track people who are on the side of the Sanctuary people, but not inside with them. I think that's what I'd like to have seen. Kind of like at the end of Truman Show, you know, when you see that woman with the posters all over her walls and you realize, oh, there are people against this who aren't watching the Truman Show out of joy. I know it's kind of a weird analogy, but I think you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, very apt. I was thinking the show could have just been an hour long, but definitely if they had some extra money and we're going to do the two-parter, I would have loved to see that spent really seeing more. I mean, we could have seen more of what Jadzy was doing. She kind of spent her time either in Brenner's apartment or at that party. We didn't see her really going out into the world and seeing what things are like. Do the people on the street realize what's going on? I think that's my question. Like, we see the 1%, and then we see the homeless people. But what do the regularly employed people, what do Brenner's employees think about what's going on?
Yeah, because if you talk about parallel to the Occupy thing, the people in the Sanctuary, they're not the 99%. They're like the other 1%. And then, then there's everybody else who's on the outside that we don't know. You know, when Jadzia is talking to Brenner in his office there, and like she's using the terminal to order her new ID and stuff. I mean, that could have been a moment where maybe Brenner, as exposition for the audience, maybe Brenner fills her in on the past 10 years of American history of what Jadzia can ask. Well, how did the Sanctuary District come to be? I guess she's supposed to know because she's from the future, but then again, she's a Trill. She's not a human, so maybe she doesn't know Earth history. And he could have filled her in on that.
You know, Earth people know Trill history.
Right. The story of
Don't know? You don't remember the third great Trill uprising of 2034?
Oh, is that the one?
That Bashir didn't even
know.
Wasn't
that called the Salt Rebellion, where they try to get rid of the slugs?
That may be right. I was going to say that I really enjoy these stories where we go to the past, but it's actually the future. We've done that a few times. And when they don't, it's episodes I don't terribly like. Or it's, you know, Star Trek IV, or it's, was it Future's End on Voyager?
Oh, yeah.
I love these episodes where they go to the past, but it's actually the future. You know, episodes where they go to the actual present. Things like Star Trek IV, Future's End, I think, on Voyager.
Future's End went to the same year we were in, so it was kind of to our present at the time that it was that it was on. Yeah,
exactly. And whenever they go to the quote unquote present, they forget to do the Star Trek timeline. It's just whatever year it is in real life,
right?
And so, but when they do an episode like this, it is actually in the Star Trek chronology, which is great because we start seeing some bits and pieces of the timeline. But I still wish they would flesh it out a little bit more. I mean, we know about the eugenics wars. We know there was a World War III. We know that something led to the events of First Contact. But we really haven't gotten any of this really fleshed out. And one thing I would have liked to see if they'd spent more time in the past was more fleshing out of this universe of what had happened between, you know, the eugenics wars and 2024 that made it like this, and where was the country headed? You know, where was the world headed? Yeah. Were there wars that were coming? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that might have been a little bit much to put into this particular episode in terms of filling in, but some of it, for sure. And it's kind of like me. I would like to have seen, if we could have spent more time in the 2024 time period, I wanted to know what led to the creation of the Sanctuary Districts.
Because
I was thinking about it again as a parallel to the whole Occupy thing, that, and like, is this what we're seeing right now? Is this kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way? I mean, right now you've got people voluntarily living in tents in groups all around the US, and in fact, I guess all around the world. You know, I see on Twitter, Occupy London, Occupy Sydney, it's like everywhere. At some point, I mean, and then you see, now you're starting to see in the U.S. The police making efforts and the government making efforts to force everybody to leave, which, of course, is viewed as a violation of free speech, you know, and the right to gather. But at the same time, I mean, do you expect the government is just going to let you block normal operations of the society indefinitely? Because that's not achieving anything either. You know, there has to be a balance there. But at some point, do they just build a wall around these occupy camps, like you see the Sanctuary District? You know, is that something that happens? Or what leads to what we see Bashir and Sisko in the middle of? I would have liked to have seen some of that background, kind of immediate, like I mentioned a minute ago, like 10 years leading up to that, like from 2014 to 2024. What happened that led to all this?
Well, it's one of the interesting things I found when I was researching for this episode on Memory Alpha. Was that Los Angeles actually proposed something like this, I believe it was while they were filming the episode, where
I remember that,
The city council
local
LA.
Businesses, the local businesses were asking, you know, can you just put the homeless people in a specified area just so that the rest of it's cleaned up? You know, sort of like Giuliani tried to clean up Times Square. They just clean up the whole city of all the homeless people and make it beautiful and pristine. And you know, on paper, it doesn't sound like a horrible idea, but, you know, it sort of takes an episode like this to show you, you know, this is actually a really, really tough, a really bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, I talked with a guy today, you know, random story. I was shopping for furniture today, and the guy at the furniture store said he was living on the streets for 5 years.
Wow.
Until 2008. He was living on the streets. And, you know, he spent all day just drinking and being homeless. And then one day he was at this furniture shop and the guy saw something about him and realized, you know, this guy, he just needs a job and he'll turn his life around. And this guy's been clean and sober ever since. He's held down this job and all he needed was a chance. And what the sanctuary districts take from people is the chance to make something better of their lives. You know, Webb would have done something, but he got thrown in there.
Yeah, then he's locked away.
Yeah, Webb was even saying, you know, towards the end of the episode, it's like, you know, we were put in here, you know, and they said that they were going to help us find jobs. Well, I don't know how many, you know, job interviews you've been on. You know, that's exactly it. These people aren't there because they're apathetic towards their own lives or towards society. It's just because they were down on their luck and they want jobs. They want to work. They're not asking for welfare. They're not asking for handouts. They want to work for their own way.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And I think, is it Bashir who makes a comment in there that I forget if it's Bashir or Cisco, but the problems are too big that the people don't know how to address them and they don't want to face them. And that's kind of what you see today as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problems that are facing the whole world, you know, especially what you see in the United States, these are really, really enormous problems. And I don't see anyone having any ideas or making much of any kind of effort to solve these problems. And what that leads to is here, it's like, okay, we can't solve our problems. So let's just take our problem and, you know, brush it under the rug. Let's put the people in the sanctuary district and pretend they don't exist. And then we don't have to solve the problem anymore. That's what they think.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what's been happening in our own world over the past, you know, 10, 20 years. And now you're seeing all the rioting all around the world because people have had enough. You know, the problems have been ignored for so long, and now it's reached that boiling point. And that's what you saw here, you know, with the Bell riots when they come in.
Yeah. And I mean, part of the problem with Occupy is I don't know if they're blaming the correct person for the problems. I mean, this is what Bashir was talking about, where the problems are too big. You know, we can't blame banks or even big businesses or even the top 1% of wage earners for the problems. It's a systemic problem. It's created by a society that perpetuates a certain style of, you know, to get ahead, you have to put other people down. And it's just, on one level, it's how capitalism works. And there are things we could do overall as a society, but it's not changes that we're prepared to make. We're not prepared to pay higher taxes. We're not prepared to we kind of have to let certain people slide by on welfare so that other people can get the things they need to succeed. These aren't values that for years and years America has held on to, but it's things that I think Gene Roddenberry would have been all for. You know, if you'd said the words welfare state to Roddenberry, I don't know if he would have shriveled up as much as they do on Fox News.
Yeah, I really like those moments between Cisco and Bashir, like when, you know, like, you know, Cisco pretty much represented the show and Bashir represented the audience. You know, he mm-hmm. didn't know mm-hmm. what was going on and Cisco was explaining
Good
to him.
Point.
Immediately, mm-hmm. Bashir got angry and, you know, said, it was like, well, you know, this is evil. Like, how could they just let this happen? And Cisco's like, they didn't want this to happen. They just didn't know how to deal with it. And
yeah,
I feel like
that's what I was. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're at that moment. And it's, I like those moments and I didn't, because at the same time, I felt like Bashir was just going to look at the camera and the music was going to stop. It was just going to go, how did it get so bad, guys? You know, just like,
and then The More You Know comes on.
Yeah. Is it basically like, The More You Know from Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so another line from Bashir in here, that this episode, interestingly, this episode was prophetic of our own world, and it was also prophetic of Deep Space Nine itself, because Bashir asked the question, he said that if push comes to shove, and if something disastrous happens to the Federation, and if we're frightened enough or desperate enough, you know, how would we react, and would we hold true to our principles and our ideals? And of course he's talking about there what happened with these sanctuary districts, but we see the same thing that happens to him and Cisco and everyone in the Federation in the last few seasons of Deep Space Nine in the Dominion War, where they kind of face a similar grandiose problem and end up betraying a lot of the principles of the Federation as well.
I think they even I like how they address those issues again in what was the name of the episode? Paradise or Paradise Lost or something?
Yeah,
where you know the shapeshifter threat was so large that you know they brought in Sisko and Odo to Federation headquarters and or Starfleet headquarters, excuse me, and. Right. You know, that all of a sudden, you know, martial law was happening and people's rights were getting taken away. And like, yeah, they didn't start building walls and putting people in who they thought were shapeshifters, but they were, you know, a few steps towards that. And we're centuries beyond 2024 by the time we're in, you know, 2373, I think is what it was.
But and, they're randomly blood testing people at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have soldiers all over the streets, all around Earth. I mean, even in New Orleans, they had soldiers all over the streets. Federation officers anyway.
I mean it's a dark future that they portray, and it's amazing because Bashir is so self-righteous, you know, in this episode saying, you know how could they let this happen, and he does say, you know, rhetorically, you know, could we ever go back that way, but I don't think he realized how easy it is to fall down the wrong path.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what DS9 is constantly trying to remind us of, is if we don't keep watching, if we don't keep worrying about what's happening, it's so easy to fall back into our darker natures.
And I think In the Pale Moonlight was the epitome of that. I feel like like at the crescendo of the Dominion War, we have, you know, Sisko making this horrible decision of bringing an entire, not just an entire government, but an entire race of people into a war where billions die. And, you know, and all of a sudden we're supposed to have Gene Roddenberry's vision of, you know, everybody's perfect, everything's great, and paradise is there. But Sisko says it's easy, you know, to turn a blind eye to something when you're living in paradise.
Yeah.
And that's the exact parallel I think. Of course, I have a little bit different view because I watch all this stuff from afar because I don't live in the United States. But it seems that's what also leading to the unrest right now in the United States too, is that the United States has had this, I'm not going to call it paradise, but a very easy life for the second half of the 20th century anyway. And as Bashir is saying, you know, if we become complacent, this can happen. Or if Sisko is saying, if we become complacent, this can happen. And that's kind of what led to a lot of this too. Again, as we talk a little bit about the parallel with this episode and the unrest, this kind of complacency that everything is taken for granted, you know, that we're tops in technology, we're tops in science, we're tops in everything. And you start to believe that it's like it's just something that's a given. It's just accepted. It's like you're given right. And then when you start to believe that, then you start to lose everything. And I think that's what we are seeing happen a lot in society today.
Well, even the writer of the episode, Robert Hewitt Wolf, was, you know, I think I read the same articles that Greg did about how what kind of made him write this episode or gave him the inspiration was when he was walking in Santa Monica. You know, he saw it was a gorgeous day, you know, gorgeous beach, and there was just homeless people everywhere. You know, as far as the eye could see, just everywhere he was walking, just homeless people. And then you had tourists and townies just walking by, completely ignoring them. He felt like it was some sort of weird, planned out juxtaposition of the natural beauty and urban decay. And you know, you get to that point. I mean, you know, I live in Chicago, and you know, there's a huge homeless problem here. I mean, a lot of them are mentally ill. A lot of them are people who are really just looking for a quick buck. But most of them are just people who are, you know, down on their luck. They want jobs, but they cannot support themselves and their family. And I have to admit, when I'm walking downtown, you're taught not to look at these people. Yeah. You know, you're taught not to look them in the eye because, you know, they're gonna tell you some sob story that you'll either believe or not believe. But it's rough because when you're surrounded by it all day, every day, it becomes the norm. And when something becomes the norm, you'll pretty much, you know, you'll take any excuse to get rid of it. Like, oh, they're going to help the homeless or they're going to get rid of them. Great. And I won't have to look at them. But if it was a problem that just happened, you know, like all of a sudden everybody started becoming homeless, then we'd be like, well, no, we can't just shoo them away. We need to help them. But it's a perpetual problem. And that's why we watch Star Trek, because it kind of helps us get ideas on how we can fix things.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up a point that I thought, I guess getting into part two, is Sisko and how awesome Sisko is in this episode. At the end of part one, where he just steps in and decides he's going to be Bell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I messaged Chris or something right when that happened saying, you know, Sisko is the one captain I would want to be on an away mission in 2024 with. You know, Janeway, Picard, Kirk, they would have done good things, but none of them would have stepped up and said, I'm going to take this iconic role. And, you know, Gabriel Bell is supposed to sacrifice his life. So, okay, maybe Sisko thinks he can make that not happen, but he knows what he's signing up for.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, Bell was an African-American too. I mean, I think that really worked out well.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, lucky for that. Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't want to be there with Janeway. She's like, the name is Gabriella. Your name is Bell. Gabriella Bell.
You can call me Betty.
Say, wait a minute. Is something wrong here?
No,
you don't look like the guy that got killed on his ID there.
I can just see, the cops looking at Janeway, that all of a sudden he just puts the ID next to her face.
Back to the ID.
All right, that looks good
to
me.
Back to Janeway.
Oh, yeah.
No, Janeway on an away mission, I'm a big Voyager fan, and I think I'm the only one. Mm-hmm. But I
have the only one. I do, but yeah, go ahead.
No, but I have to agree with you, Greg. I mean, I really like Janeway, and but I like her. I like her on the ship, and you could probably count on one hand how many away missions Janeway has been on. And
they have a rule on the ship.
Yeah.
Right.
Janeway doesn't go on away missions, but
no.
I would.
She does
not...
in the Voyager pilot that aired right after part two. She goes on that away mission. That doesn't turn out too well.
Oh yeah, and she screws up time, right?
Oh yeah. good job.
That just jogged my mirror. It's just another one of those planets I like, that they go to planets in Star Trek and like everybody on the planet wears the same clothing.
Oh yeah,
that happens to look very similar in fashion to Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah,
Federation clothing.
Seinfeld has a joke about that. Like he was talking about how much time it takes and effort to pick out what you're going to wear. He's like, I can't wait until it's the future and everybody's wearing the unisex jumpsuits.
Yeah, it's right.
You know,
exactly. Nice.
It's like somebody, like one government official's like, okay, we're spending way too much time on fashion and clothing. We're all just going to wear the same thing. Yeah. Once we're a part of the galactic community, everybody will be able to recognize us.
And that's when...
Yeah, I mean, I see, Chris, you're already wearing your unisex Starfleet miniskirt, I see, so...
Oh, yeah, well...
Oh, the scant?
I was inspired by watching Encounter at Farpoint the other day, and, you know, those scants, man, that's some...
They're fashionable.
They're very fashionable.
You know? You go to the gym too. And you work on your legs, and you want people to be able to see them.
I feel like it was a quality gone too far, with at least in fashion, because in real life it could never go too far, but in fashion maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
It's possible.
So in the future, like now the government gives big contracts to Halliburton, for example, but in the future, like the Federation government, they hook up with like Ralph Lauren. They get the contract to do like the unisex jumpsuit, and every year there's a new model, a new fashion, right? New design comes out.
So. I'm not sure if Tristan listens to the show every week and knows how we go off on random tangents.
No, I listen.
This is pretty much par for the course.
I'm just seeing like Tommy Hilfiger, Tom Ford, Ralph Lauren. I'm just seeing them all around a table and just like government officials just trying to get their ideas on paper. And like
and they're all bidding. Yeah,
they're all bidding. They're like each one has 300, you know, page packet in front of them and a fashionable scarf that goes with it.
Although they hate when they have to actually go and bid in San Francisco, because it's kind of hard since there's no money. they prefer to go out to DS9 and they bid, and they're like, well, I'll do this for you for 18 bars of gold press latinum.
Or 15 hours of holodeck time.
Right.
Yeah. They prefer the holo suites, you know, a little bit racier than the holodeck.
Yeah.
Unless it's one of Riker's programs and minuets in there, but...
Yeah,
What were we talking about? Past tense, right? We're talking about past tense.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about past tense.
Past tense.
Oh, goodness.
Speaking of Riker, Jonathan Frakes directed Past Tense Part 2, which we're talking about this week on The Ready Room.
That's right. That was interesting, actually. Yeah, that I had forgotten about that. And as I was just kind of looking over notes, I remember that Jonathan Frakes did direct Part 2 of this episode.
Yeah, they say that.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to, according to the notes, they say that this episode pretty much solidified his slot to direct Star Trek First Contact. So,
I mean, this could have been Insurrection. I mean, if it hadn't been an episode, this would have been a great thing to do for a feature film, in my opinion.
I never thought about that.
I mean, we talked about that a little while ago, like different episodes that would have made a better follow up to First Contact.
Yeah, I guess it could, because if you think about the ideas in here on a big screen scale, I mean, a movie motion picture production scale with that kind of budget and that kind of time. I mean, I guess the time would be kind of similar, but I have a feeling it would have played out very, very differently. As a motion picture. You were saying, though, about you would want to be with Sisko in this situation. And this highlights one of the things that I really like about Sisko. I sometimes think that Sisko is one of maybe the least liked captains amongst Star Trek fans for whatever reason. I think some of it is because there are a lot of fans these days, because of where we are in terms of how long the franchise has been around, there are a lot of fans whose entry point was Voyager. And so they really like Janeway because that was their first Star Trek show that they really got into. And now they've gone back and rewatched the other shows. And then, of course, you've got Kirk as the classic, Picard, the person you would, I think, trust most to protect you, to make the right decision. But I always like Sisko because Sisko is this kind of take charge guy who's not going to take any crap. I like when he punches Q Q-less? Is that the DS9 episode?
Yes, it was Q-less. I think it was season one. Yeah.
It was early. Yeah. It was like middle season one.
Yeah.
And he punches Q and in the pale moonlight, Tristan, that you mentioned there, I mean, Picard would have never done what Sisko did in the pale moonlight. And
not a million years.
As bad as some people think those actions were, and you can look at it in several ways. You can also look at it that, you know, Sisko made a decision that had to be made. It was a really, really hard decision. But in a way, he was also doing it for the Romulans, because if the Romulans sat on the sideline and watched the Dominion take over, they were going to be next. And he had to make them realize that you're going to be next and we're not going to be here to help you because we're going to be gone. It's going to be you versus them if you don't get it. You know, and maybe the methods were bad, but they were hard, and that's what had to be done in that situation. And Sisko takes charge in that way, in the way that other captains don't. And in this episode, that's what had to be done. You know, he couldn't go and think, he couldn't go sit in his ready room, and he couldn't have, you know, Troy come in and say, well, how do you feel about the possibility of being Bail? I mean, you know, and what would your grandma do? And if you drink some milk, will you feel better about your decision? You know, Sisko had to decide on the spot that, and I know I'm making fun. Trust me, I love Picard, and he's probably my favorite captain of all the captains is Picard. So I'm not like trying to belittle Picard here, but it is a difference in the philosophy. Yeah. And Sisko had to decide on the spot that I'm Gabriel Bell. And even if it means that I die in this, someone has to step up, because we can't let this moment.
Someone has to step up in history. Someone has to step up and shoot a trash can with a shotgun. That is very important.
I think that moment. I think you
hit it on the head, Chris. I mean, between the differences between Picard and Sisko. I mean, with Picard, and the Next Generation altogether, it was very much reflection. It was, we are presented with a problem. Let's get the best of the best. Let's get the senior staff of the Federation flagship on board, so we can make the best decision we can, the most moral decision. And Deep Space Nine was all about the frontier. This was a crew that was kind of a hodgepodge. I mean, we have a former terrorist. We have a young never been tested doctor. You know, we have a person with seven lifetimes in a. A commander who pretty much was going to leave the Federation, and they're presented with all these problems that no other Federation crew has been presented with. And you know, like you guys said, you know, Sisko is all about taking action in the moment, and Picard is much more reflection. I think that's the dichotomy right there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Picard could have done what Sisko did, but only if it had been meticulously planned beforehand.
Yeah, yeah, right.
We're going to go down. I'm going to be this guy. I'm going to do these things. You're going to say that. Sisko could improvise. And one of the stuff I really liked was his interactions with Vin, the sort of older, gruff security guard.
Yes, oh, yes, yeah. That,
yeah. Where he was just trying to explain to him, look, I'm trying to help everyone. And you are, I know you're trying to do good things, but you are actually literally part of the problem.
Yeah.
And he just, the way he just took control of that situation and just stood down this man was really impressive and something I couldn't see any of the other captains doing.
Oh, no, no, because Picard would have taken him off to the side and tried to calmly reason with him and make him understand, you know, the history behind situations like this. And, you know,
cite
and Sisko just
treaties.
Slams him. But right. So please sign here stating that you will no longer agitate BC.
Picard would never yell at BC about how he didn't like his hat.
Oh, I like that too. I don't like your hat.
That was, I think, my favorite moment in the entire episode.
But I like, yeah, Sisko slams.
Oh, that reminds me. Was this episode aired before or after Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? Does anyone know that offhand?
And the Last Crusade?
I think it was after.
The
scene where BC sort of gives his hat to Webb's kid is just like that scene at the beginning of Last Crusade where that guy gives Indy the hat. Well, when Indy's the kid. And I'm trying to think, are they making a reference? Is it just a weird coincidence?
Yeah, Last Crusade was in
89. Very odd.
And this was in 95.
Okay, so this was much later.
Yeah. So I'm sure, probably.
And everyone...
Maybe they're doing a little reference.
This has been Greg's geek moment for this episode of The Writing Room.
Random geek connections.
So I like to... we should move on from this, but I like when Sisko...
Yes.
But he slams Vinny against the wall... And yells at him a little bit. And what I was watching it, and I was thinking, like Frakes is thinking that, well, this scene has gone on a little bit too long, so Sisko needs to slam him into the other wall and then finish his thought. You know, it's like grab him, slam him into the other wall, and then go on. It was just that kind of made me laugh just a little bit in the middle of what I thought was a very good exchange.
I like that Frakes directed this episode because I love Frakes as a director, and I also feel like I remember when I was younger and DS9 first came on the air and we kind of saw what kind of commander/captain Sisko was. And I really felt like, man, if Riker got his own command, I feel like this is like, this is what we would get. I feel like this is the closest that we're going to get to
definitely a
Riker show because he's much more shoot from the hip.
Great.
That's right.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, he doesn't have the swagger like Riker has, but no, nobody does.
The swagger. So would you guys agree with me that part two was better than part one?
Yes.
I felt like it had the more action. It put down the technobabble was handled a lot better. Obviously, we got the resolution of the story, but so often part twos don't handle that resolution very well. I thought Frakes handled it really excellently. And in scenes like you were mentioning with the slamming Vin up against the wall, the scenes were staged really well. Like, it felt like you were really there in a hostage situation.
Yeah, I think so, probably. I think it depends on what you like. Part one here, if you're really, really into just the social commentary side of it, I think part one had a lot to offer there. But you do have a lot more of that techno babble going on and the B story of them trying to find Sisko and Bashir in the past. And then in part two, I guess the good thing about part two is you do get more of that action, but you still get the social commentary angle as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, abandoned there. I don't know. I tend to, with this episode anyway, I tend to think of it more as one long story as opposed to a part one, part two.
Yeah.
Because it feels like it was, even though, it was the same. Both parts were written by Ira, Stephen Baer, and Renee Echeverry, I think. And the teleplay was handled differently. Not Echeverry, Robert Hewitt Wolf and Iris Bear actually wrote the story. And then the teleplay for part one was by Wolf and part two was by Bear and Echeverria. So I think that the writers were, you know, the same. Sometimes you get these part ones where someone writes it and then they like they don't know how to resolve it and they hand it off to another writer to finish it. And in this case, I felt like it was a good solid story that was written from start to finish. So I think of it more as just one story, one episode, really.
I actually forget that it's two episodes. Like when you guys said that this was the episode you're going to talk about, I was like, okay, I should go rewatch it. And I completely forgot that it was two episodes when I went on to my Netflix queue.
Yeah, I really feel like they did a great job with these two episodes. I mean, it was sort of end of the year, beginning of the year. And as we talked about, this was leading into Voyager as well. I think they did a really fantastic job in a way they didn't always with these two-parters of really making one cohesive story. And I'm really glad it wasn't a season finale because, as you say, they very often just left those on a crazy cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And this episode didn't really have a crazy cliffhanger, and that was nice.
Right. Yeah, this would not have worked as a season finale because there wasn't enough for me. Like, if it ended the way part one ended, you know, I'm Bill, Gabriel Bill, you know, and then we have 3 months to wait to find out what happens. Yeah, I wouldn't have been anticipating so much because you know they're not going to die, right? And so it's like,
right,
you know, the Federation's still going to be there in the future. There wouldn't have been very much to worry about in that case. Okay,
yeah,
well,
definitely.
Why don't we just close here? Just final overall thoughts about the episode. Anything that, you know, any way that it speaks to you, anything from the Star Trek angles, anything that you might have wanted to do differently if you were behind the camera, in which case you would have gone on to direct First Contact and become very famous in the Star Trek community.
Yeah, Chris, one thing I didn't actually get a chance to mention, so I mentioned in my closing, was how Bashir really came out really well in this episode. I felt like he sort of took he was behind Sisko as far as Sisko was doing the main things, but I did feel like he was a great sidekick. Like, I would have rather seen Bashir there than Kira or even Jadzia. I thought he was really great, and especially since I've been watching some early DS9, this reminded me of how Bashir's character evolved from somebody really distasteful and unlikable to someone that you'd really want with you in a stressful situation. And so I wanted to say that about Bashir.
I definitely agree. You know, yeah, he was the best of all the possible sidekicks for Sisko.
Yeah. But just, you know, in general, this is a really just great episode. And it's one that I don't think of all the time when I think of great DS9 episodes. I usually think of those later Dominion War episodes, or I guess the early ones as well. Those sort of standalones. But this really is Star Trek at its best. It should be thought of up there with Sitting on the Edge of Forever, and I'm trying to think of one from Next Gen that was of this high quality, maybe something like Unification. Mm. I really think it's up there on that level.
Yeah, as I said before, I mean, I really enjoyed the episode, and I think you're right, Greg. I feel like Bashir was the best possible sidekick. I mean, sometimes you'll watch a Star Trek episode and you can tell that it was written for the main person and then the sidekick was interchangeable. But I feel like this one was specifically written with Bashir in mind. And for that, I applaud it. I like the episode. I don't usually go back and rewatch this one. But then again, I don't go back and rewatch Unification over and over again either. I feel like these are the types of episodes that you watch just a handful of times because they have such a great message. You get it and then you move on. It's not exactly a fun episode like Star Trek can be known for, but it doesn't mean that it's not a good one because the message is so clear. And on the same token, I like the message, but I felt like it was a little heavy-handed at times. And I feel like it got some criticism for that in 1995 when it first came out. They felt like it was a little too heavy-handed, but I feel like we need that sometimes. I was reading in the notes that Forrest Gump came out at the same time, and it was the feel-good movie of the year, and the producers was like, well, Forrest Gump was in The Sanctuary, he'd be homeless too, or something like that.
But he could run. Sometimes he could outrun the guards, though.
Exactly.
Sometimes things that seem really heavy-handed at the time they come out, you know, once time passes and we see the reality of the situation, it can seem a lot more prescient and a lot less heavy-handed. Just, you know, as I watch this episode, I don't see anything, you know, overly pushy about the agenda. I just see a situation that I could totally see happening and real people trying to deal with it.
Yeah. I think you mentioned earlier, Greg, that this at the time that this came out, economic times in the U.S. were actually quite good. You know, the mid-90s were a pretty good time, especially if you compare them to now. So I think at that time, it can be taken more as a heavy-handed preaching message because that kind of thing wasn't really going on. I mean, there were homeless people and so forth, but it wasn't that bad. It wasn't as bad as it's presented in this episode. So you, at that time, people feel like, you know, they're being preached to a bit more. And when you watch it today, you see like, wow, this stuff is actually happening right now. And so it doesn't feel so much like you're being preached to. It feels like you're being shown reality in a way.
Yeah.
And that's, for me with Star Trek, well, first of all, this episode is on my list of the five best episodes of Deep Space Nine. And I think it's third on my list. And I sometimes get criticized by our listeners and readers and followers on Twitter about my choices for Star Trek episodes, because for me, Star Trek has always been not about the spaceships and not about the aliens. It's about looking at ourselves, and it's about science fiction as social commentary, and which Star Trek does very well. And, you know, the original series was very preachy and very heavy-handed in its messages. But we need that sometimes. And you can't necessarily talk about things. Like, if you try to talk about this problem, you mentioned Fox News earlier, but you take Fox News, you take CNN, you take any of these, you know, mainstream media, or it doesn't even have to be mainstream media. It can be anybody, really. You try to sit down and talk about these things, and all you end up with is a bunch of arguing where one side sees it one way, the other side sees it the other. No one wants to compromise and no one wants to find solutions because we're talking about ourselves. And in science fiction and in Star Trek, we can talk about these problems by putting them on alien faces or other planets, or in this case, it's on Earth, but it's in our future, so it's not real right now. So we can talk about it that way. And that's what Star Trek's always been about for me. And I think that this episode in particular does that very, very well.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, guys. Well, that was a nice heavy-handed closing there for our discussion. But it was a fun, interesting discussion. This, again, is an episode that we could probably go on and talk about for 3 or 4 hours, especially if we wanted to delve into the technobabble and the bus that the hippie couple climbs out of and then watches O'Brien and Kira disintegrate in front of them. But we'll wrap up for today. So Tristan, it was great that you were finally able to join us. I know it's kind of hard to get you on during football season because we tend to record on Sundays and you're tied up. So we're glad you were here. And can you want to tell everybody where to find you around the interwebs?
Oh, you can find me at The Insane Robin at Twitter. You pretty much, once you go there, you can find me anywhere else. I got a Tumblr. I have a Google Plus profile, and it's all under The Insane Robin. So just go ahead and follow me there, and I'll follow you back. I follow Star Trek fans immediately back. And I'm a huge nerd on Twitter. That's pretty much all I talk about is geek stuff, mainly Star Trek stuff. So if you want to have a conversation or a nice argument about who you think is better, Kirk, Picard, or Sisko, or even Janeway, if you want to throw it into the mix, go ahead and find me there.
Well, Chris, I'm always glad to talk about DS9. It's kind of, for me, the overlooked Star Trek, because I just didn't get to it until recently, and watching these episodes is going to be my third or fourth time of watching the episode ever, as opposed to Voyager, which I'm already on my fifth or sixth or seventh or 8th, 9th, 10th episode viewing. So it's a matter of sort of relearning the show and remembering how great these episodes were. And watching them in sequence is so different from just picking out an episode and thinking about it for a whole week and just looking at these little details. And it's really great to just go over it with a fine-tooth comb like this.
Yeah, right. Looking at the details. And this is a great example of the kind of show that Deep Space Nine is and became. More realistic views of society and the world.
Yeah.
As it is now, and as it'll probably be in the future, because at least within, you know, a 300-year time frame, you know, maybe if you could go out thousands of years, maybe our sensibilities evolve more. But I think it's going to be a rocky road.
Yeah.
A little bit more rocky road than the Next Generation suggests, and Deep Space Nine paints that picture for us quite well.
Yeah.
And I was glad we could have Tristan on with us too. We've been trying to have him on forever, but because of his work with covering the NFL and us recording on Sundays, it's always a trick. So this week, because of different reasons, we're recording on Saturday, and we were able to have him on. And everyone, be sure to check out Tristan on Hyper Channel. If you don't watch our Hyper Channel show, comes out every Thursday. It's a real quick, around 4 minute. Video dash through Star Trek news. It's all presented in HD. We also have an SD version, and you can get it in iTunes. So you'll find Tristan there, and you can see him with his impressively spiky hair, as some of our Twitter followers have mentioned before.
Nice.
All right, Greg. Well, let's remind everyone where they can find us. If you go to our website at trek.fm, you'll find all kinds of Star Trek discussion, commentary, games, activities, just pretty much anything you can imagine related to Star Trek there. Even a few glommers, which always makes Greg very happy.
Yes,
and if you want to share your thoughts with anything we've talked about today, you can go to trek.fm/contact and send us a text message there. And you can leave us a voicemail if you'd like. You can call 646-652-TREK. We'd love to hear your voice. And of course, you can find us on Twitter, where we talk about Star Trek all day, every day, at username TrekFM. And you'll find Greg on Twitter as well.
Yeah, I'm there at Greg Harbin, G-R-E-G-H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N. You'll find me mostly tweeting these days about Occupy Seattle.
Oh, really? That's your primary feed these days, huh? So no Wonder Years anymore. No,
I've sort of moved out of the age of innocence, and I've realized that unemployment is on the rise, and the only way we can stop unemployment is by living in tents at a community college.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll follow Greg if you want to keep up with with that. I have a feeling that somehow that's not what Greg is tweeting about all the time. I just have this feeling. He's actually tweeting about the whale probe all the time and how much he loves Star Trek IV. So anyway, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And I'm tweeting about all kinds of things. Surprisingly, not as much college football as I do most seasons. Things have just kind of swept me away this year. But it's getting interesting, so you might catch a little bit of that. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can find us on Google Plus. If you go to our site, you'll see a Google Plus badge there in the sidebar. And you can also use our short link, which is hyperchannel/TrekFMG+, I believe it is. So that'll jump you over to what is normally an extremely long URL. Well, Greg, I'm going to head out and go down to KFC and make sure that the Colonel still is fully dressed for Christmas, even though you guys are about to have Thanksgiving over there in the States.
Great, Chris. And I want to wish everyone in Trek FM land a happy Thanksgiving and let everyone know it's time to stick some ablative armor on it, because the Ready Room is done.